Yeah. Rebecca Wolf.
Okay. And talk to just me, because not everybody out there necessarily knows what you do.
Yeah.
I'm sure most people do, but not everybody. You're,
no.
You're a force in this environment.
Hardly anybody.
That's your view. Yeah.
So I write poetry, and I write fiction, and I also am an editor and publisher. I publish and edit this periodical, literary and art periodical.
Called Fence.
That's right. You couldn't. And yeah, and that is what I do. Mm-hmm. I write.
And you write, and you have a line of books also. That you
that's right. Of course. Yeah.
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 Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And where do you live?
I live in Hudson, New York.
You live in town.
I do. I live on Union Street, Lower Union.
No, don't give them your address.
No.
Because people show up there tonight.
Don't come over.
Without calling.
Yeah. Although I was thinking, apropos of art, I was thinking of having some kind of open Sundays kind of idea.
Mm.
You know, not immediately, but it did occur to me how lovely that is as a sort of, you know, as a means of getting the disciplines to be in some kind of communication, like to just, you know, open your house. A friend of mine was doing like a salon style thing every month.
Include me in.
Well, that one's over now, so it would be nice to start some other kind of, just an informal thing.
Yeah, actually, Linda Weintraub, and who is an artist, also a curator and a teacher and educator, and written books on art, has a show on the Dvorsky Museum at the present on nature and art, and I think it's called Dear Mother Nature or something like that, but it's got a lot of interesting artists in it, and she and Raquel Rabinovich, an Argentine artist, lives also in Rhinebeck, used to run a thing they call a peña, and peña, P-E-N-Y-A, is a term that you get in South America a lot. For a kind of salon, but it would involve all kinds of art. You know, it could be poets, could be guitar players, and dancers, could be the whole thing.
Definitely.
And they ran one of those for years, and I was part of that for a number of years in the Hudson Valley. And you know, Carolee Schneemann used to come on occasion. You know, all kinds of people would come.
Yeah.
Very interesting artists, and it was very productive because they were real artists, real poets, real, and it was very productive. Actually, people would get their work together for the thing, and have something to present, and actually it was a force.
That's cool.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd have to think about, I think part of my idea is that there would be no presentation, it would be like sharing ideas, you know, really, I mean, basically a cocktail party is what I'm really talking about, but that you know, the population would be curated in that everyone would be aware of themselves as artists in that context. Like, I'm here because I make art.
Ah, right.
Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. When did you start writing poetry?
I was very young. I started writing poetry when I was about 12.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah.
And, I was pretty serious about it. My themes haven't changed much. It's a pretty consistent thing that I've done since then.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And what turned you on to being a poet?
Reading. Yeah, which is what I was thinking about as I was thinking, what is art, or what is poetry?
Yeah.
And I realized that my immediate assumption was that I should think about that from the perspective of the maker of art, like the writer and the poet. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe it's just much more interesting for me, or... Sorry, I'm a soft talker.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just more
that's better.
Pertinent for me to think about what is art from the perspective of the, you know, the reader, like the person who comes across it. Because that's what I did. You know, I just came across. I mean, I read. I was just always a big reader, and I remember, you know, being shown poems in school, 7th grade, 8th grade, and being just really, really struck, you know, by the poems, just really moved, really shocked, really surprised by the language, specifically, you know, I mean, anything from, like, the wasteland, you know, things like, I mean, just these giant...
When you were 12?
You know, yeah, when I was actually, when I was 12, actually it was Jay, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock was mm-hmm. I had a teacher who showed it to me. I mean, I was really interested in writing already, and so she approached me with it. On an index card, yeah, a little, like, part of it on an index card. Sweet. Yeah.
I wrote my 11th grade term paper on T.S. Eliot.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, but so it's that thing of, like, how an artwork, if you're disposed, I guess an artwork, when you, if you're exposed to it at the right moment, it is like a giant permission thing where you just, even if you haven't been steeped in, like, art making as a child or something, it just, and the thing that you and Susie, what's her name, were talking about that really struck me was that question of how you were saying something about, how did you say this, about how you basically have to trust yourself as an artist. I mean, it's just a very basic...
It's a very powerful reality to zero in on, actually. It's something that interests me more and more.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because I take up different art forms to challenge my principle, actually. I call it axial principle, which has to do with being very free in the origin of what you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that interests me, and it's also, by the way, about not using talent and not using skill, but getting to something so authentic within the possibility of the medium itself that you it really discovers itself inside there. And you have to get to a certain point in there before that confidence arises. And I'm so interested each time in finding what point do I really feel like it knows what it's doing. I don't know what it's doing.
Right.
I never get to that point. But it knows what it's doing. And that's
right.
the...
Which is really interesting because I came at writing poetry from a fairly similar instinctual perspective that basically I have to get out of the way, in a sense, of the language.
Fantastic.
But what's funny is that kind of, I mean, there's a conflict, there's a crying child outside, that conflicts with ideas about, like, it's interesting to me that you would say that gets rid of that whole talent problem, because there's, like, talent and the individual, you know, the individual genius, sort of, like, which is this concept that takes us away from the fabric of life and et cetera, and, like, you know, promotes this notion of the artist as somebody who's removed.
Right.
Which is what we're all trying to get away from, anybody as being removed
from
stuff.
Or that everybody on the planet is removed to some degree.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's right. That this is nothing, you know, unusual. So.
Olson liked to quote Heraclitus saying, "We are estranged from that with which we are most familiar." Yeah. As the human condition.
Right. So, yeah. So that thing about having—I used to talk about it as being like, you know, conviction, essentially. Like, why did I have that? I don't know. You know, why did I have that so young? That I don't know. But I did always kind of.
Now,
have
maybe
this.
That's one of the signs of being a poet or an artist, is that you can't account for your own conviction.
Right. And it, and then at times you can start to think that maybe it's just hubris.
It's hubris, and
but
I think I'm special.
But so I was thinking, what is art? Art is, and I came up with my formulation.
Oh,
it is the magic of referentiality.
Mm.
Like, such that, okay, everybody thinks that they can point to something and that the other person will know what they mean, you know, or see what they mean, or see the direction that they're pointing. And as an artist, you have, like, more faith, extra faith, perhaps, in your ability to point to things.
Mm. Or, yeah, something like that. Or that you're... that the pointing isn't really quite the same thing as pointing at an object. but that there are alternative ways in which pointing occurs. That's to say, you say something and you are referring to something because you know it's there, but it ain't there in any obvious way. So it has to be there by, you use the word magic, by conjuring that reality.
Right, well, that's what I mean about the extra faith.
Yeah,
like, because maybe it isn't there.
Maybe, yeah, right.
or
there in
yeah.
a very special sense only.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I was trying to say about that. But so then, yeah, so now I've already lost sight of what it means to look at art, at what art is from the perspective of somebody who's not necessarily mm-hmm. making it.
Mm.
And why is that... like, I don't think that should be less important in the question of
right.
who's making art, what is art for.
Yeah.
But I've always been making it, so I don't know.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. Well, you're also alive, and you didn't know that either. I mean, you didn't figure that out in advance, as far as you know. But if you did, you haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah.
No, I think that there's a way in which things are... is another great... why is also in my mind say? There's another great thing he said that came from the Tao Te Ching, I think, which that which exists through itself is what is called meaning. That which exists through itself is what is called meaning. We're always thinking that things have to somehow be justified or explained. And so the whole tendency of the history of art and history of all the arts has a tendency to look for explainable origin points, psychological, intellectual, influential, contextual, social, as though that is going to somehow explain the emergence of this phenomenon. And it takes away from the simple fact that the thing, first of all, is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is with a force. How do you explain Emily Dickinson? And they try, there's lots of different books to try and explain Emily Dickinson. And there are all kinds of good things to think about, you know, and they're mm-hmm. kind of fun to think about. But actually, you come back to the poem, and you realize it's got its own life force.
Right.
It's as powerful as a tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Although I do wonder, I mean, I used to be, and can we open these windows before I...
This one opens, too. There's a lot of noise out there before.
Yeah,
so
no, I know the kids
we close them at that point. Yeah. Good, yeah. No, it's a little hot.
I mean, that kind of brings us back to the individual genius problem, which I'm still really attached to it because I feel like it's a... I mean, it's not Emily Dickinson's genius, it's the poem's genius, right? Genius is just not even a useful word.
Well, maybe it's... Maybe. Unless you take it back to Genie in the bottle.
right.
Yeah.
And her own formulation, I think, about words sort of having an aura.
Yes, that's right.
And all that, which I certainly experience.
Hello, I vote for that.
Words definitely, especially words on the page, right?
Yes, I mean, right. Or when they get when you are able to bring them into your sphere in a way that you can perceive the aura, yeah.
Right.
It goes by kind of quick when it's in the air.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... Yes, but then I also wonder, to try to be more generous about it, I guess, is like, well, so what was there around her own writing that that was, you know, collaborative with it, that we don't know about?
Yeah, sure.
And that, you know, and not like, oh yeah, her sister wrote beautiful letters to her or something like that, but I don't know, just whatever the...
Right.
Fabric.
But what about, you know, one thing about that, you know, we hear people speculate, and it's a romantic fantasy, of course, a great theme of romanticism, that children retain quite often, or at least quite often that we see it or hear it or understand it, retain a kind of sense of the magic of language. You say something and they're, you know, it's like a child hiding, and if they think they're hiding, if they can't see you, you can't see them, even though their body's out here, and the thing they're hiding behind is this wide. It's a little bit like that, right? I mean, it's that words, that the sense of that children have of the power of language, that almost that you could conjure reality with it, that's something that is drummed out of us.
Wow.
And that somebody who lives in isolation, relative isolation, but with a contact with a certain poetic force, in the written word that she's exposed to, like Emily Dickinson, could retain more of that.
Hmm.
There's some kind of, independent authority in her language that is so impressive, it just hits you every time.
Mm-hmm.
How does she get off saying that? Because it's right.
Right. And I mean, she is not alone, right? There are other, this is the kind of poem that I gravitate towards, or that really, I guess for me, articulates and, validates, I guess, like all the effort I put into publishing poetry.
Yeah.
It's definitely still attached to finding that kind of experience in language.
Uh-huh.
And there's other kinds of writing that I really appreciate too. But for me, I mean, so I read, I find young poets who are as kind of like, kismetically, hermetically right. conjuring.
I like that. Hermetically, hermetically conjuring. Yes, indeed. that's a whole wonderful description.
Yeah, but it is very romantic. I mean, it is a super romantic way mm-hmm. to perceive what that experience is all about. And so I've come to also really appreciate, I guess, the kind of writing that can kind of put that away a little bit and place more emphasis on the communicative aspect. So when I was talking about the magical referentiality, what I meant, so then I said extra faith, like that extra faith is the thing that gives a poet the freedom to point to something that is not there. Or that, that...
Or the poem to point to.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's interesting how the poem takes on its own life and takes and gains authority as it does that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I guess then the... there is a lot of writing out there that has more intentionality vis-a-vis the reader. You know what I mean? Like, has more of a more explicit desire to talk to somebody. And I get more and more interested in that as I publish more and more people because, oh no, I lost my thread there.
Oh, it'll come back.
It'll come back.
Mm-hmm. Threads blow in the wind.
Oh, I know what it was. I know what it was. And I'll finish it.
Yeah, good.
Because there's so much darn writing out there these days, so
right.
much poetry, and I start thinking, where is this all coming from? Like, why are so many people calling themselves poets, wanting to write poetry, without necessarily reading so much poetry, that whole phenomenon. And then I think, oh, it's because in another time, they would have been fantastic letter writers.
Mm.
Like, they would have been brilliant correspondence with their people. And that's just not part of our life so much anymore. And so
that's a very interesting thought. I had never had that thought before. It's as though the permission of the private letter to really say what you want to say without fear of judgment, what widely conceived as judgment, but really held to a certain privileged discourse.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry seems to offer that
mm-hmm.
to people, that permission to go ahead and say what's really on your mind.
Really
do what's necessary for you to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which might have in the past had more of a like personalized landing place.
That's
although
right.
another way to think about it is that, and how might relationships have actually been different in a time when that kind of communication would be person to person, you know?
And also that in an age in which poetry is not as bound to literary convention, even though literary convention exists in many forms, some of it kind of insidiously hard to find, but it's there, that in such an age that permission that was once an epistolary permission
mm-hmm.
is now clearly in the domain of the poem,
mm-hmm.
whereas it, before it had to jump over a few heat, mountains before it could claim that permission. It had to be a sonnet or be whatever it had to be.
Right.
But now it doesn't have to be any of those other things in order to be what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Funny. Yeah.
Interesting. We're discovering the truth about poetry today.
Ta-da!
all these things are finally appearing.
He's not even listening.
Yes, he is. He listens. He can't stop listening. But So yeah, you know, one back to one thing that I was thinking before, really sure what we were saying, is that that sense of the authority in the poem, or that permission to be clear about your own rightness in the moment. It's not a rightness in general. It doesn't accrue to the overall identity of the person. It doesn't accrue to your authority as a human being in general. Mm-hmm. But it is here on the spot, and it's coming into its own. There's no doubt it has a kind of certainty mm-hmm. that arises in that moment. It's the certainty of what is clear to itself. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that now I know who I am and now I'm clear in general. It doesn't work like that.
No, it has no relationship. In fact, it's almost like an inverse, possibly, relationship.
Because life is devoid of that so much. But it shows life the possibility that you could be like that in every moment. That's theoretically possible, that human beings could be living with such clarity and such authenticity in their language, mm-hmm. if nothing else, mm-hmm. that they could be in that clarity all the time. But as soon as they start to believe that's true about themselves, and maybe have in that part of the romantic myth of the genius and all that, then they're going to destroy it, mm-hmm. because it needs a kind of innocence, it needs a kind of immediacy, and a kind of openness and humility. Actually, the poem breeds a certain humility. Hmm. You know that identity in general doesn't easily accept.
Right.
Yeah.
Because identity is always in relation.
In relation, and it's defensive, and it's
right,
yeah.
right. It's yeah. constructed, it's, yes, yeah. defensively.
It's defensive, it's so absolutely self-protectively.
Yeah.
And that we prove ourselves in order to not be as vulnerable to the distinctions, failure, irrelevant, nobody, can't come to dinner in my house, you know.
Yes.
No seat at the table, as somebody recently put it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We're so afraid of those things.
Right.
And the art becomes a meal ticket or an entree or an identity card.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it is a consolation, I'll say,
yeah, sure.
that sense, like when I write a poem these
yeah.
days, mm-hmm. I am aware of, I have that feeling like, oh, well, at least this still feels good.
Well, that's a well-earned consolation. You can feel good about that consolation.
Yeah.
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 There's no nonsense there. It's just true.
Mm-hmm.
That you be consoled.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Well, we're saying what poetry is in a lot of different ways. Do you have any special, particular thoughts about it that you wanted to share? Not to put you on the spot.
I have to fan myself with my literary magazine.
Yeah, right. That's really good for that.
Special. Well, I thought about referentiality. Poetry. I mean, it's kind of confounding these days. The poem, and the ways in which, you know, that kind of language is different from the language that is out there.
Maybe it's not.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not what's true about it, that it's different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something's different.
Right. What is different?
You can try putting the fan on, even if there's a little noise, and point it at
I'm
Rebecca.
Okay. Yeah, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you feel it?
I think so. I may just be kind of faint from excessive thinking.
Oh, yeah.
No, just joking. But
I can feel that.
You know, it's funny because I wasn't really thinking about what is poetry. I was thinking what is art. So.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, art's fine.
But
last I checked, poetry was a form of art.
Well, exactly. Exactly. It's a community. It's an interface. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's kind of where I got to with it. It is it's like a two-way mirror interface experience. You know, the art I most recently saw that I had a real, memorable response to was I went to see Gerhard Richter's small show at the Pompidou in Paris, and I was told before I went that this was not a particularly good sampling of the work, and that it was very small, and that it was maybe, you know, opportunistic. Maybe it's just there to make some money for the museum because it's a, you know, it's a no-brainer. Everybody's going to want to go see it, blah, blah, blah. And so all of the context of that was there when I went into the show. And then also being a fairly self-conscious viewer and reader, like, of art. Like, sometimes I have trouble... I have trouble just experiencing the art experience that I'm, so it's hard for me to get all the stuff out of the way of, like, the plaque next to the work and the people around me looking at it and the you know, the room that has been set up and the way that, what, you know, what I've paid to see it and all that kind of stuff. And so I did think that some of the work was amazingly successful because it, like, shot through all of that, you know. There were these little, his recent work were these little under glass, it was paint smushed under glass, really, really vibrant sort of psychedelic colors, and just paint smushed under little, I don't know, what am I going to, plexiglass, really. Yeah. And it was completely gorgeous, compelling, transcendent, you know, I hate to use the smart quotes, but it just, you know, unparaphrasable, like, I, you know, you can say stuff about it easily, but, so art would be, like, extra. Art is extra. That is what art is for me. It's just, it's extra to, it's like extra life.
Art that didn't come from either a predictable or otherwise justified source, but just somehow arose there. You
know? But I mean, it was completely justified by the environment that it's presented in.
Yeah.
It's already been, you know, ratified, and, like, this is art that...
Did you see that documentary?
I did, actually.
It's really good.
Yeah. I really liked it.
I liked it a lot. And as a matter of fact, I have not been consistently a major enthusiastic, sorry.
That's okay.
An enthusiastic fan of Richter's work over the years all the time. But I became much more so after seeing the documentary, because I realized the kind of innocence with which he...
It was really funny, I thought. I was surprised that somebody with the... you know, the sort of the range that he's famous for in making all these different, just like, interjections into art, would be so kind of, you know, classically, he's like a refusenik, I think.
Right.
I mean, listening public, his responses to questions about his work were sort of like, I don't know, I think it's good.
Right.
I only make it if I think it's good. If it's not good, I don't do it.
Right.
You know,
or
I stop.
Keep it, or I change it.
The
way he kept changing, you know, things. And,
It reminded me of this is, you know, this has always been my favorite kind of artist too, and I feel like it's really naive of me. And maybe we need to understand who are these artists who, like, either because they're incapable or because they're temperamentally unsuited to it, or whatever, refuse to enter the discourse of art, like refuse to discourse about their art. Like, John Ashbery is a little bit like this in my experience, my limited experience, but he would rather not talk about, you know, about poetics. He's certainly not, doesn't seem, you know, he's obviously...
Not that he's naive, because his,
not at all.
His art criticism is very sharp.
Right. But it's not... like theory-based, you know, he's not really particularly.
It's not theory-based. It's not opinion-based in a certain way. It doesn't have a dogma.
Right.
And it doesn't take away.
It's not ideological.
It's not ideological. That's a better word. There might be theories involved. Sometimes they're not visible, but it's not ideological. That's what you're right.
Right, which I guess you could say it is, like, there's that whole argument about transparency, like that, you know, that is in itself. Being, like, that he's representing an ideological stance by not seeming to be ideological, but it's not. It's, like, qualitative, right?
I think that's argumentative. In a courtroom, that would be considered argumentative.
Right. But so he's just having this response to stuff. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. But it's not that he's afraid of complexity in the theory.
No.
Because after all, look at the people he defended in European art, you know, and which, you know, very complex theoretical positions. But he didn't, that wasn't what was, he wasn't turning that into an ideology, really.
Right.
It was something much fresher.
Right.
And it's also, he's, like many great poets, he's writing the same poem in different modes, moods, and states of energy, and focus, and contextual framing. But he's writing his poem. He is writing his poem. You're clear about that.
Yeah.
It's just coming out. And Richter is doing what he does, what he feels good doing.
Right.
You know, he has to feel good doing what he's doing. And, I don't like that.
Yeah. And maybe that was the funny thing about that film, is the interviewer was kind of trying to catch him in the moment of creation, which,
yeah.
maybe the moment of creation is the least articulate, you know,
yeah, right.
moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Hopefully. But,
But you know, he gets these highly intellectual questions in the film from, you know, the German-American art historian critic.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Anyway, and he just kind of like keeps evading that focus, and
right.
the way he just slipping past that focus, and the answer won't come that this intellectual focus wants from him.
Right.
Kind of put words in his mouth, he won't have them stay there. They won't stay in his mouth.
I love that, and I
agree with you there. It resists conforming to anything that other people think should be the case.
Right.
And there's something very fresh about Richter that I actually, because of the fact that he had two separate painting identities, one abstract and one figurative, I don't think I actually appreciated where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me to be an exercise in, since nobody else has really done this before him, maintain two separate workshops,
mm-hmm.
two separate identities, two separate, I mean, figurative versus abstract, that's the whole big discussion.
Right,
about
right.
Art.
No, he's like, I don't know, I'll do both.
I'll do both, yeah, right, see how it works out.
Right, which is, yeah.
But the essence of that view, I never saw before that, that documentary. It
interesting.
Because
yeah.
it seems like the high sophistication and high proving that I can do both, or something like that, and the kind of arrogance.
Yeah.
But it's not. It really is not.
No.
And I had never saw it before. The film was very, very important for me to see in that respect. I have a good feeling about him.
Yeah.
If I'd only seen the abstract art, I probably would have liked it better. Or if I'd only seen the figurative art, I would have, you know, been interested in it in a different way, you
mm-hmm.
know. But seeing both was always kind of complicated for me. Not that I think it can't be done, but it just somehow struck me. Well, maybe also because, you know, by the time you come to Richter, he's already been lionized.
Well, that's just it. But I guess, so just to talk about myself a little bit more.
Let's do that.
Because I write fiction as well. And so there's, I guess it's a little bit maybe similar, not to hold myself up to Gerhard Richter, but just that when I have written fiction, like my attempt with it is really to try to understand that form, like, you know, not as a poet writing fiction, but to I really do feel quite separate, like the two forms of writing are completely unlike each other.
And how's it working out?
So I don't know. You'll have to read my novel. Tell me what you think.
Is it finished? Are you finished?
I published a novel two years ago.
2 years ago. Okay, I guess
and
I didn't see it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and now I just finished my first ever short story.
Oh.
And yeah.
Are you a big novel reader?
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about big.
Yeah, but you read novels.
I read novels.
Yeah.
In fact, I've read much more fiction than poetry.
Really?
Uh-huh. Other than poetry that I read for Fence, like as my job as an editor.
Interesting, yeah.
Do you not read fiction much?
I don't much these days. I read them when people ask me to read certain things, I'm drifting away, am I? When people ask me to read things, or when I have a reason to read it, I'll read it. But I won't very often read it just to read it, unless I go back to something like rereading Melville or something like that that I need to do for something I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
I need to understand better about.
Well, you know, it is such a relatively young form, the novel.
Yeah.
That in a way it makes sense to me that people at this juncture are kind of going back to something like, to earlier novels to just sort of revisit how it's sort of got going, you know?
Because
the form is sort of, I don't know, it's like deteriorating a little bit. Seems like
could be. I couldn't verify that because it's so much of it being written just like poetry.
Yeah.
To pretend that one is in any sense in command of what is currently the case is it would be very difficult. If someone reads a lot, you could make that kind of statement because there are people who read every new writing that comes around.
Maybe deteriorating is not the right word. It's just it's in flux. I mean, it's as it has, I guess, always been, but just with the differences in publishing, in the publishing world,
yes,
kind of affecting what people are willing to publish, what people are then willing to take on as long-term projects, and all that kind of stuff. So,
Are you writing more poetry or more fiction at this point?
I've been writing poems more. Mm-hmm. Poems take very little time for me to write, so I always write poems, no matter how busy I am or whatever else is going on. I always write them. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to be going to an art colony in a couple weeks and writing prose.
Which one?
The Millay colony.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be up there for two weeks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I need like blocks of time to write prose.
Yeah, yeah.
But poems, I just write them while I'm driving, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, that's kind of the nature of the art form. So it's sort of spontaneous and now. It's a very now art form.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of its attraction points for me, that you can live inside those kinds of absolutely spontaneous moments. I mean, they come up for you, for me.
Yeah, they do.
Uh-huh. And in a sense, that's almost one of the... Because it poetry is not the same as literature. Poetry is not a literary art form. It has been incorporated into literature, but poetry is very clearly and obviously a previous art form, an earlier art form, a primordial art form. Hmm. I mean, it has always been.
You mean the lyric, like,
Even that's literary. I mean, who knows what it was, you know? I mean, what the early utterances were. Maybe cries, maybe that's a lyric, or something of that nature.
Although I guess there could be collective cries. Like, cries could have been more collective in the past.
Who knows? You know, the point is that it's all speculation, but one thing is clear, it's pre-literary. And it's pre-written, it's pre-literate.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the literary forms that we now find things, like, for instance, the Orphic hymns or something like that, or these very early, very strange documents that come up. They retain something of the authority of the oral, in the sense that they don't follow a logic of the text that's been imposed by literary models.
Mm-hmm.
Literature always has models. It always has something that is pre-written before it, you know, and it's looking back or it's evolving something out of a written art form.
But do you not think that poems at this point have a very hard time escaping that?
I do think that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always been a question for me about, like the original, you know, I'm posing all this stuff as like, I used to be so naive and now I'm so wised up, which is hardly the case, but I did sort of come up in poetry with this notion about like, producing something not derived from literary tradition.
Uh-huh.
And then that comes to seem like this other kind of hubristic sort of like anti-communitarian statement that and so
well,
I wonder.
I don't know. I mean, to me, the value of recognizing that poetry is pre-literary is that it doesn't require those models.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it doesn't mean the question of whether you can escape them or not is not the primary question. It would be odd if we could escape them, since they've had so many centuries of authority behind them now. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they don't require it, that the impulse doesn't have to come from a previously existing mm-hmm. literary model.
Fascinating.
That it can have a more fundamental impulse.
Right.
Whatever that is. It could be many things. It could be theoretical. It could be personal. It could be pain in the moment. It could be
none
of the above.
No, that explains so much for me. I never really... Because uh-huh. that impulse...
Yeah.
Right, that is so that's both the beauty and the problem of poetry, like in the professional discourse. Again, that is the problem that people grapple with, like, it's really just a publishing problem. It's like the way spit up is a laundry problem, you know? When you have a baby, you go to the pediatrician, you're like, my baby's spitting up. And they're like, it's a laundry problem. It's not, you know, there's nothing wrong with your baby.
right.
It's sort of the same way with poetry, that people, like, everyone writes poetry, you know, because it is this legitimate,
right.
It not legitimate, but it's just this, it is
it's
this.
Real.
Yeah.
It's a real and option, human option.
Yes, it is a human option. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so then, but then there is the problem of terminology almost, like, you know, well, why can't I get my poetry published? Because it's not really, like, up to the standards of the art form?
Or it's not interesting. It's just, you'd be very simple about it. It doesn't interest me. Your poetry doesn't interest me. I'm not going to publish it.
Well, but it's funny because then you're... I guess the question would be, can we be, as readers of poetry, can we be pre-literate, you know?
Well, can you be real is the question. Reality is pre-literate. Is
pre-literary. Literary.
Reality is pre-literary.
Yeah.
Reality wasn't invented by literature. And literature does not have the authority to determine what reality is. I have no problem with literature. There's been great literature all along, and I love it. But I don't recognize it as having the authority, the tradition as having an authority.
Right. Have you already published, like, an essay on this subject?
Well, I've published different things, yeah.
Yeah, you should write about this for me to publish.
Yeah. Well, I'll write something for you about it.
Yeah, that would be great, because I mean, this is something, this kind of really gets at, like, the heart of my difficulty with knowing how to be a publisher, essentially, with knowing how to be, a professional, with my own inclinations, which are as I described them, like, in terms of, like, what I'm really interested in about poetry is that impulse. And so I can fall in love, you know, with some awful manuscript that's submitted to me as a publisher. And when I say awful, I mean just not up to the standards of the art form. You know what I mean?
But if you're falling in love with it, isn't it possible you could work with that person to get...
Oh, no, I'm talking about just really awful.
Awful. Uh-huh.
Or, so unschooled as to be, like, you know, like, clearly written by somebody who could not... It would take a lifetime.
But what is your what is it that you're loving about it?
Different things. I mean, I'm not thinking of anyone particular. This is just something that happens to me all the time as an
editor.
But
isn't it something about its freshness? Something that its aliveness. It's in there somewhere.
It's
something.
What it is generally is it's the idiosyncrasy.
Yeah, well, there.
Inborn kind of strangeness.
Yeah.
You know, and I get into so much trouble in the literary field. Mm-hmm. For speaking like this, because it's not professional and it's also not it doesn't support, like, any of the ideological perspectives that are out there that carry weight and stuff. So,
well, I'm not big on supporting the ideological authority of any one of those perspectives, you know. I must say I prefer some to others, perhaps, but I'm not big on their authority. And it's never worked out. There's never been an authoritative position that has worked out as something that has to be honored beyond the force of its time. Because those things drift, they change, and they should change. And, you know, the question is, what is their function? And there's something previous to them that the actual poet, the real poet, retains, and it's also in other people. It's not that the poet is the sole purveyor of this reality.
Yeah.
And that's why children can write the most amazing things. That's why children poetry that Kenneth Koch used to promote.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's so charming. It's you know, screw it if people don't want to give it a category of importance or reality. When you read it, you know damn well that this is very close to what poetry is about in some sense. Doesn't mean we should canonize it. It doesn't mean that we should put it over and above something else. It does mean that it's a reminder that there's something that the professional position maintains that has lost that primary force.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no getting around that. You know, we get jaded. You know, we get too professional, we get too clever in our position. And I have very mixed feelings about professionalism anyway.
Well, I know. I mean, it's hardly even worth trying to figure that part out. It just so happens that mm-hmm. I make my living in that field.
You do,
and want to, and mm-hmm. like enjoy it and all that stuff. So
yeah, listen, I've been editing Station Hill Press for 32 years.
I know.
And I know about that problem. And I've edited anthologies and all kinds of things. And I don't have a problem with it anymore. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that gives me not having a problem, allows me to not have a problem with it, is having discovered that thing we started this whole conversation with, that sense of rightness, and it gives you a feeling of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
It's not certainty about being right about poetry, or being right about literature, or being right about anything that I might say. It's a different kind of authority. It's a certainty. It's a non-authoritarian and non-authoritative certainty. It's a certainty that belongs only to its moment,
mm-hmm.
and to its occasion, and to the event that it is. And that's an authentic moment of human being.
Mm-hmm.
Poetry is connected to the nature of being somehow. And we can't philosophize that into ultimate clarity, but we can know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you say it's preliterary, you're saying it retains that thing that human beings have somehow. Why is there poetry in every society that has language? Why is there something that we could anthropologically associate with what we call poetry in every society that has language?
Mm-hmm.
It's always there. It's something human beings do. They play with language. They work with language. Language is connected to how consciousness evolves,
mm-hmm.
how consciousness has found itself to be. And we don't know why that is. There are thousands of interesting theories, and I love speculating on those things with people, but I don't believe in any of them.
Hmm.
I mean, they're not occasions for belief. Let's get rid of belief and just have experience of it.
Right.
And experience it all, experience of thought, experience of everything. And be very direct about it, and be in the open, and be clear that I don't wish to be anybody's authority about anything. I've lost that impulse. And if I ever really had it, I stayed out of the academy successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So after having taught for a number of years, and I managed to get out and not want to go back. And that's because I really can't stand an environment that thrives on authority.
Yeah. Right. It's a big old fallacy.
It's deadening. You know what got me out of it? Seeing what happened to women in that context. Women became like those boring men around them.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to get them alone and say, like, hey, what's going on here? That's not, I just heard you have this conversation in the hall, and that's not you, you know?
Hmm.
What's going on here?
Hmm.
We're down to 10 minutes of our time. Well, I should remind our listening folks out there that we are doing Art as Poetry as Music Is, and right now Poetry Is with Rebecca Wolf.
I actually forgot we were live on the radio.
that's what makes the conversation so real. It makes it so great, actually. That's the thing that's kept me doing this project for 10 years. 10 years.
Wow.
Over 1,000 poets, artists, and musicians in 11 countries and 21 languages. What kept me doing it is that people forget what's going on. And we just get into this incredible space. And I've done that so many times, and it's a real thing. People appreciate the opportunity to somehow really talk about these fundamental questions.
Yeah.
We don't talk about them.
Yeah.
You know, it's a suppressed discourse.
Right. No, I mean, I have actually been talking about not poetry, well, even mm-hmm. poetry, a little bit like this in the last little while,
uh-huh.
just because, well, and I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, not every day, but
mm-hmm.
but I have just had occasion to sort of be in a mode of, you know, less suppression, or no, less, you know, hesitation about kind of going to these sorts of subjects, and find increasingly that people are actually, just people in general, are more willing to go there.
Interesting.
So it's kind of a good thing. It's probably, you know, Mayan. It's a Mayan calendar. 2012 kind of thing.
The only trouble is they've now discovered that there are several other Mayan calendars.
Right.
They're different cycles. Which I'm happy about because I do not want to think apocalyptically, frankly.
No, no,
I'm not in the mood.
No.
I'm not in the mood for the end of the world.
No. Not at all.
Right. I'm having too much fun, actually. And my work is going too well.
Oh, good.
I dare the history to interrupt that at this point.
That's good to hear. Yeah.
I think that it's the natural state of human beings to be creative. I think it's their natural state. And I think that when we are not, we're experiencing something like a social disease that has taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to re-examine very fundamental questions. Politically.
Right.
Artistically, you know.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it seems as though the place of art, you know, back in 2001, around the 9/11 stuff, there was all this kind of questioning amongst poets, specifically, you know, what is the role of the poet in society, and how can we be activists with our writing and such, and I think that none of those questions have gone away, but I think that it has all just sort of sifted into a more generalized question that everyone is asking themselves, like, how can we be more effective, or how can we be more...
Yeah, but poets preaching to the choir about their political positions, or artists preaching to the choir,
exactly.
Has very little effect.
Yes.
And they're abandoning maybe the domain in which they could do some real shift in language and consciousness. When they do what they do best, really be radical in their expression, and not be bound either by guilt or by that sense of social responsibility that's only external because we've just experienced a trauma. Well, why now? There were just as many traumas in the world before. What kept me from seeing them? 9/11 is only the American experience of what countries around the world experience all the time.
Right.
You know? And also, there were two great wars in which people raised these questions very significantly, and Yeats has a poem called Lapis Lazuli. I don't know if you remember that poem. Check it out, Lapis Lazuli. And it has to do with this. What is the role of poetry in a time of when people say that you should be paying attention to these other issues and give up this crap? You
know? And I didn't mean to say that the fact that poets began to question their role then sort of somehow created more of a dialogue around the citizen's role or something like that, but more that, I guess what I was trying to just say more is that what I hope for and I seem to see is more just that, and I'm just saying this as part of the question of, like, what is poetry?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is art? because for me that begs the question of, like, what is its role in society, you know, in the culture? And so... Do I mean begs the question, or is that the inappropriate? That's the wrong way of using that. It doesn't belie it, and it doesn't beg the question. It brings it up.
Yeah,
that's all
I mean. That's right. Exactly.
It involves it. It includes it. Is just like, what are the ways that people feel called to engage with, you know, the subject matter of their times, and so, So I have nothing interesting to say about that at all. That's where I got with that.
But poetry does give us the opportunity to experience a new level of that each time. 4 minutes. So we have 4 minutes. We have 4 minutes.
Oh.
We only have 4 minutes because this program ends at exactly 6 o'clock.
That's right. And so what have you concluded, George?
Me?
George, what is poetry? No, we did figure that out.
George does not conclude.
No. What have we...
I gave that habit up a long time ago. I used to conclude.
What I really meant is you've been talking to so many people.
Yeah.
So what has that been like?
It's been wonderful.
Yeah.
Actually. I think it's been, without exception, wonderful. Yeah.
Cool.
And I think that pretty much about 1,000 people that I've done over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Which comes out to about a person every 3 days, even though it doesn't happen like that. It happens like this, a bunch of people in one day, and then I do it for a couple of weeks. You know. Or somebody comes by my house and I do it, but, you know. Or I used to track people down, but I kind of stopped doing that. That's probably after 10 years of it. But it's still interesting.
Do you find that people usually approach it from the perspective of, like, what does it mean, what is it to me?
I encourage them to do that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, one goes into that intellectual focus or that cognitive focus about trying to get through an infinitely complex set of questions.
Right.
And if you approach it cognitively, there's no authority again. No certainty, no clarity. You don't know where you are in the question.
Right.
You know, but if you've really come from yourself, where you are now, this is not final. This is today's conversation. We could have this conversation again next week or next month. Re-filming people is very strong in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done
that would be great.
I haven't done it a lot, but I have done it somewhat. And it's definitely an interesting thing to do. It helps us see that it's not about having an opinion that we stick by. It's about, can we really bring everything to this moment?
Right.
And that's what a poem does in language. It brings everything you've got to that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So there we are. Any last words in the last 2 minutes?
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Beautiful radish on your plate.
Yeah, absolutely. An uneaten radish, because I realized it would make too much noise if I chomped on that so near this microphone. But here we are, and it's been great really talking to you. We haven't talked this much before, have we?
No, definitely not.
Talked a little superficially at cocktail party kind of situations or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is great. It makes me want to talk to you a lot more.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm glad it doesn't make you think, ugh. Not Rebecca.
No. You know, the marvelous thing about this project is what comes out of people is very real.
Yeah.
And I like to think that that's the design of that the project was actually real in that sense.
It's a very provocative project for me because I do really decline authority or certainty most of the time, and so to try to land on anything is just it's a real unusual effort for me.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, I'm honored that you made that effort in this context, you know? And we have to thank the people of this great station for creating a really bigger context in which this sort of thing is possible.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is a fantastic thing, fantastic
it
reality.
Really is.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And thank Galen. And
all right, we've got about 12 seconds left. Do you have any final thoughts?
Thank you, everybody, for listening, if you have been.
All right.